the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with writer Tom Seaman, who grew up in a family of 14 on welfare and food stamps in the projects of Toledo, Ohio. He tells his story in a page-turning book. It's a memoir called Animals I Want to See. Then child therapist Natasha Daniels talks frankly about childhood OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, in her new workbook for kids. It's called Crushing OCD, 50 Fun Activities to Overcome OCD with CBT and Exposures, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, that is. That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest, writer Tom Seaman, grew up in a family of 14 on welfare and food stamps in the projects of Toledo, Ohio. He went on, in a story he tells in his memoir, to graduate summa cum laude from Yale and then from Harvard Law School. His story is a can't-put-down book called Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. His escape from a crowded house in the projects was work, from scrubbing toilets to amassing a sizable paper route and everything in between. It's an incredible story, and Tom Seaman joins us now. Tom, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you for having me today.
This is just such an incredible story. I feel like all of our kids and all of those of us who are parents need to read this book, especially those of us who are guilty of making the path too smooth for our kids. What does it make you think about with today's kids?
Well, it makes me think about the old question about nature versus nurture. You know, how much of this was already built into me when I came out of the womb versus how much of it was learned or how much of it was parented into me, you know? So I too have kids, and I think about this as well, because they're growing up in a way that I didn't grow up. You know, I grew up very poor and they're growing up quite well off. So it is a question, how do you give them the motivation that, say, I had or even less than I had, because I had quite a bit of it, as you read in the book. How do you do that with kids? It's a great question, you know?
You were encouraged and inspired to tell this story by President Bill Clinton. Can you tell that story? How did you come to know him, and how did he know about your story?
Right. So I had met Bill Clinton once before, and then, you know, I had an event at my house, frankly, that he came to. Because it was at my house, he had been prepped on my story somewhat. And, you know, he grew up poor too. So he was talking to me before the event, and he's famous for focusing on the person that he's speaking with. And he's very focused on me and my story. And he says, you have to write this book. And so, you know, I was already thinking about it because I had told the story before, and people were always surprised. You know, they never guessed that my background was as it was when they met me. So I had already been working a little bit on it, but his push inspired me to do it more. And then when I wrote the book, you know, I went back to him and I said, hey, I wrote this book that you encouraged me to write. Will you give me some support? And so he said yes right away. And he gave me a blurb for the book, which now appears on the book's cover. That's how that happened.
Wow, that's wonderful. It's so encouraging when people who are in that level of power and influence give you that kind of support. That must have been so encouraging when he told you that initially.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was really supportive. I found it amazing that he was so into the story, such that he was just, once again, very focused and talking just to me, I felt. So yeah, it was very encouraging. I've had a lot of support along the way, because you put a lot into this. And when it comes out and pleases others and inspires them, it's definitely very encouraging.
Yes, there are a number of big names that really can't say enough good things about your book. So we're very happy that they're behind you. I have some questions. You mentioned nature versus nurture. So you're from this huge family. I thought I was from a big family. I'm the eldest of six, but that's small potatoes compared to you guys.
Right.
And how do you think it was that you particularly came out with such a sense of resilience?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, people say, well, you were raised in the same house by the same parents, so why didn't everybody sort of come out the same? And part of it's, once again, nature. We were born differently. But secondly, you know, we didn't all receive the same influences. You know, maybe a teacher encouraged me more than my brother, or maybe someone took up my cause. You know, the book is really a collection of small kindnesses, as I like to say. You know, when I was writing the book, I realized people had done kind things for me in my life. But when you write it all down and it starts to appear on a page, you really recognize how many kindnesses were done for you along the way. I think writing the book has made me a kinder person, in fact, with that realization. And so I say my life is really a collection of small kindnesses, first starting in the neighborhood, you know, which was a primarily Black neighborhood, and we're white. So that itself was interesting, and it started there. And then it gradually went outside of the neighborhood as I was given more opportunities to experience things outside of the neighborhood. You know, I was given a chance to go to camp for 2 weeks by someone who donated 2 weeks of camp to our parish. And my brother and I were chosen as the recipients. And I think kids in these circumstances need to see what's out there in the world. They need to realize what to dream for, and they can't realize what to dream for unless they are given these opportunities to see what's out there. You know, I was given free art lessons at the Toledo Museum of Art, which was very eye-opening for me to experience art at a very young age and to create art at a very young age, and on and on. So it's this collection of small kindnesses. But was I driven more than my siblings? In some ways, I think I was, you know. All the siblings before me went to the public high school, which was not a very good school, in my opinion. And I had this desire to go to a private high school because I thought it would, frankly, lift me more, make me have greater possibilities in my life. And I was always very driven to success, whatever that meant, you know, as a young child. But I just knew that moving on and moving out into the world was my definition of success at that time.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Tom Seaman. He's written a memoir. It's called Animals I Want to See. It's a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. And I think, Tom, for our listeners, if they could just understand just quite how poor your family was. And I think it really hit home for me when you moved to Bronson Street and you got the bigger house in the projects. It was all part of the Housing Authority.
Right.
And you're so excited. You and I think there were just 10 siblings at that point. You came into the house and there were so many cockroaches. Can you describe that scene?
Yes. So we're moving from one area of the projects in East Toledo called Ravine Park Village, which was these brick buildings with flat roofs. There's a picture of the Ravine Park in the beginning of the book. It looks like a prison, you know, there's no trees, everything is barren. And we're moving to this newer area of projects called Bronson Street, where we're going to get our own individual house because we have so many children already in our family. And we think we're moving to paradise. And when we get there and open the door, the house is infested with cockroaches, like just everywhere you step, you're stepping on a cockroach, it seemed. We start to realize, hey, it's not paradise, but we still think it's much better. And, you know, my father sort of mocks it and says, ah, paradise, you know, so this is what it is, or something like that. My father being a very difficult man, you know, alcoholic, first of all. But on top of that, I think he was a very mean person who, I'm guessing, hated his life and took it out on his family. And then you have my mother, who was this, you know, saintly figure who was just extremely hardworking and just modeled, you know, going the extra mile to her children. She didn't just get all the work done. I mean, I'm raising four children, and I just think about cleaning behind them and doing the wash and all these things that me and my wife do. And my mother's doing it for 14 people. And by the way, those 12 kids were all born within 15 years. So it's not as though some of the older ones were leaving the house as the younger ones were coming along. We were all living together, 14 of us in that small house, for decades together. And then, but she would go the extra mile. She would clean the windows, but take them out and then have a screwdriver with a rag wrapped around it, cleaning the rungs where the window goes back in, you know, in the projects, always going the extra mile, you know, making cookies. And she wouldn't just make chocolate chip cookies where you just put the dough on the pan. She would make cookies that she would have to roll out and then fold the corners over the little apricot piece. And, you know, just making art every day in her baking and in her cooking and in her sewing. And as soon as she made these dozens of cookies, they would disappear right before her very eyes as her 12 children just gobbled them up, you know, her art disappearing within a short time after she made it, she would just do it again the next day. You know, just a tremendous example, my mother.
And as you say, she had this tremendous sense of calm over her. She just handled everything. And obviously you grew up to be a lot like your mom in a lot of ways, just going the extra mile. And you did that even as a kid. Can you describe, I don't know, a lot of, say, high school kids these days, you know, they're too busy with their extracurricular activities to go get a job and to know what it feels like to work hard to make your $15 or $20 an hour, which for you at that point, well, you didn't earn money because you had to pay off your private school. Talk about the jobs and your kind of sense of pride that you found through doing those jobs.
Yes, I definitely, that's definitely an attribute of me as a child, and I hope as an adult. You know, my mother convinced the local Catholic school in the next neighborhood next to ours to allow us to go to the school if we worked at the school, because she couldn't afford to pay even $1. And I think back then it cost like $100 a child. So she asked the priest if we could go to the parish school if we worked, and he said yes. So we were the janitors of the school. And so from the third grade, I think I was the first one to do it, because I asked my brother, who's a year older, whether he did it. He said no. My older sister did work in the rectory, but I think I was the first janitor. And so we would not only clean the school during the year, some we would mainly do it during the summer, you know, the really big cleaning of the school. And as I say in the book, I would, for example, reach, when I'm cleaning the toilets, I would reach behind the toilet and clean where no one would see and when no one was watching me. You know, and this discipline that I think I got from my mother of going that extra mile, eventually it begins to get recognized by adults. You know, they don't see everything you're doing, but they begin to see some of the things you're doing. And that starts to pay off as adults start to adopt you or whatever, or take you under their wing. And this led to more and more, I think, of these opportunities. So going this extra mile and taking pride in my jobs. I was also always amazed by the responsibility given to me as I grew up in these jobs. So, you know, I was given the opportunity to drive tractors and cut the grass of the Toledo parks, and just driving down the road, driving this tractor and taking it to parks, you know, this huge piece of equipment entrusted to me, or someone throwing me the keys to their car and saying, hey, go get lunch at McDonald's for us, and driving this brand new car. You know, I'm just amazed that people are entrusting these things to me as I'm growing older. This sense of responsibility and importance was very important.
This book really resonated with me so much. Much like one did years ago that I found so wonderful was The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls.
Yes.
So if you enjoyed The Glass Castle, Tom's book, The Animals I Want to See, is probably a book you should check out right away. It has that same sense of enduring positivity. You know, people are happy to complain about things and to talk about all their woes. And I felt like you were able to describe really harrowing things that happened in your life, but through this lens of enduring positivity that wasn't cloying at all. It was just truly inspiring. Is this a practice, this sense of gratitude, or can you talk a little bit about your approach to life?
Yeah, Mary Beth, that's good that you brought that up. I did begin life with a strong sense of wonder. So one of the early scenes is when we go into the field behind our house. You know, later in life, I realized it's just a dumping ground of trash and things, but with my eyes at that time, you know, we would go into the field and we would turn over an old refrigerator door that someone had dumped, and there would be a snake, or out would jump a rat or something like that. And I began to keep this list of animals I have seen in the wild. And eventually later in the book, when I'm at camp, I lose that list and I start a new list, which is called Animals I Want to See One Day. And that's where the title comes from. It's sort of, you know, later it's a metaphor for everything that I hope to accomplish in my life, you know, which was to achieve some level of success. But I had this natural sense of wonder when I looked at the world. And, you know, the sense of wonder is something that we tend to lose as we grow older, because all the cares of life and the stresses and things come in and work, and you stop looking at the world with wonder. And so I've tried to hang on to that sense of wonder while looking at the world. And part of that is still the continuing list of animals I want to see one day, which I still do. And I take my family now, and they've all gotten into it as well, to go out into the world and to see animals in their natural habitat. And we continue to do that. And the book ends, as you remember, with a scene where I get to see one of those animals as an adult. Yeah, very large, important animals. So
oh, it's really, really great. Another thing that came up a lot in the book was your ability to navigate areas that might be really high conflict for a lot of people. Things about race, black and white relationships, things about economic disparity. Can you talk a little bit about navigating that world, those kind of challenges?
Yes. You know, when you're a child, you can talk about these things, I think, more easily because you're more innocent and people aren't judging so hard. You know, one of the people that I admired as a child was Muhammad Ali. You know, he was a very, I think, attractive figure in a lot of ways. You know, he not only was the heavyweight champion of the world, and it inspired me to want to be the heavyweight champion of the world. Strangely, even though I wasn't even a boxer, you know, I had this idea that I wanted to be either the heavyweight champion of the world, the president of the United States, or the richest man in the world. These were my very young aspirations.
I like your aspiration levels. Nice job.
Right, right. So there's a scene where Muhammad Ali, you know, who also had this really charming way of speaking or attractive way of speaking, you know, but then I learned that he says, you know, the white man is my enemy, you know, and I'm like, hey, how can that be? I'm a fan of yours. I'm a supporter of yours. And you're saying that. And so I asked my black friend in the neighborhood, you know, why is there this tension between black and white? Because you're able to do that a lot more easily when you're young. He doesn't provide me with some deep answer because we're just little boys, but it just shows that you can talk about those things. And then as I'm growing older, and as we, well, first when I'm seven and we make that move to the new projects, you know, we're the new white family in the black, primarily black projects. You know, I do take a few punches, you know, because that's how it is. But gradually you are accepted into the community. And that's when, you know, you begin to see these acts of kindness from first people in the community and then people outside of the community toward me. Yeah, I think that you begin to see, hey, we're all, you know, in a lot of ways the same. You know, a lot of the people in the neighborhood, a lot of the parents had aspirations for their children too. You know, they want them to be successes as well. And so there's a lot of commonality there and there's a lot of kindness there.
We're speaking with Tom Seaman. He has written a book, Animals I Want to See. It's his memoir. He grew up in the projects in Toledo, Ohio, and he goes on to earn his BA at Yale and then goes to Harvard Law School and tells a story about it. You don't get to sort of arriving at Yale until the very end, really, of the story, or, you know, towards the end.
Right.
It was important for you, obviously, to tell the story about your childhood. That's the more important story. That's what set you up for the person that you are now. How did you decide to have lesser focus on who you are now?
Yeah, and that's a great question. You know, as I was writing the book, you know, making the decision when writing a book about where to end is a very big question. I didn't want to write the book going into my adulthood, first of all, because I think it would make it more of a business book because I've, you know, gone into business and had some success in business. It's a different readership, right? It's a different book if you go into your adult life about succeeding in business or something. And number two, I didn't want it to be a book about, hey, look at me, you know, look at where I came from and how successful I've been or something like that. I wanted it to be the story about the acts of kindness and the growing up, what it was like. It's also a book about a place and time. You know, it's a book about growing up in the 70s and then moving into the 80s as I went away to college. I wanted it to be that story, a coming of age story, and not the alternative that it could have been if I had gone into my adulthood.
There's such an overarching message in the book, and it, you know, going back to using that word resilience, which is almost an overused word these days. We really, as parents, it's so hard to, you know, you don't want your child to experience pain, but you want them to develop resilience and find, you know, and be able to navigate the difficult waters. And I'm wondering, you know, going back to how your mother raised the 12 of you to how you're raising your kids now, if this were a parenting book, what would be the big takeaways here?
One of my children once said to me when she was young, Dad, I wish I grew up like you because you had all these really cool experiences and it made you, you know, tough or whatever, and it would have made me tougher. But I think, you know, is that for some children like me, it was a good thing maybe the way I grew up and the way I was raised, because it did make me into this driven, as you said, resilient person, hardworking, self-sufficient, making it all on my own. But it didn't work for all children, right? There's a lot of children for whom that's crushing and it doesn't work out so well. So I have children who don't have those same hardships, but we certainly try, you know, we try our best not to give them everything, not to pave the road too much for them, but they obviously have a different path. And as a parent, I'm trying hard, you know, to figure out the right way to do that. Fortunately, I have relatively motivated kids, you know, compared to what I could have given what they've been given in life. You know, I just think back, you know, in the hardest times, and everybody, no matter how they're raised or how much wealth they have, has hard times. And in the hardest times, you know, I always believed that I could change my ending. And if I can convey that somehow to my children, that in your hardest times or whatever, what's the story you're telling yourself? You know, if you, because you tend to believe the stories you tell yourself. And if you tend to be in a hard time in life and you say, I don't have any hope, versus I can change this, I can take control, I can make a plan, I can work hard. Because, and that sounds, you know, maybe cliche or something, but as a child, I did make a plan. You know, I had plans all the time. I was making lists all the time. I was making my way out. And I guess that's what I've tried to convey to my children. But it is a bit harder in the circumstances in which my children find themselves, you know?
I have heard a number of really accomplished people highlight some of the difficulties in their early lives as being real launching pads for deciding the kind of life they wanted. One of the characters in the book that really stood out for me a lot was your dad. He sounded like he was pretty tough. He was a fairly negative guy. And as you mentioned, difficult. Yet here you are and having done great things and truly coming with such a wonderful approach to life. If you have difficult people in your life, what would you recommend people try to do to work past those tricky parts?
Right. Well, I mean, the main thing I can say about that is just what I experienced myself and my father. There's that scene when I'm in the fourth grade where the teacher asks each of the students to tell what's the greatest thing each of your parents has given you. And some of the students stand up before me and they say all these glowing things, you know, almost to the point of unreality or something. And I stand up and I say, the greatest thing my mother has ever given me is she's always there to help me. And the greatest thing my father has given me is an example of what I don't want to be. So taking it as, you know, I think that my father helped me a lot of ways in life. You know, one of the vows that I take, I make a lot of vows as a child, promises to myself. And one of them is that I'll never take a drink of alcohol in my life. And I never have because he was alcoholic. So I think using those negative influences in a positive way, you know, just like I used growing up in the projects in a positive way, in the sense that I was driven to sort of get out, you know? And so those negatives can be very formative and can be positive if you can make them that way. You know, it's once again, taking control of your life. You know, the book is about me taking control of my life from a very young age, very much on my own. As much as my mother was tremendous, as much as the small kindness has helped, I was very much self-driven, you know, so much so that when I wanted to go to a private high school, I figured out how I would get there by myself. I wasn't asking teachers, how do you do this? Or my parents, can I afford this? I just calculated that I could pay if I did this and did that. You know, it's kind of amazing looking back. Who is that boy, you know?
It is. It's amazing yeah. looking now. Right. My last question for you is, I know there are some organizations out there that try to provide some opportunities for kids who, as you mentioned, really need some examples of good things to shoot for in their lives. I think Fresh Air Fund is one. Do you have any recommendations for things we could support as we come across kids who are really ambitious and have a lot of pride and we'd love to see them succeed?
Yeah, well, one that I support and that I'm, you know, heavily involved in on the board is the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston, which definitely does that in a really amazing way, you know, provides, as I said earlier, opportunities to see outside what's possible so that you know what to dream for, or what to drive yourself toward. And then, I mean, another one that I do is, you know, my wife and I have established a scholarship at my high school in Toledo, which is St. Francis de Sales, which is a college prep, all boys, coat and tie kind of school. In my neighborhood, it was known as the sissy school because of the coat and tie part, and that it was mostly populated with kids from better neighborhoods. But we established this scholarship that doesn't just provide financial assistance to boys that go there from lesser backgrounds, but it actually sends people from the school out into the neighborhoods to talk to community leaders and teachers from schools where St. Francis normally doesn't draw from. And it says, and they say, do you have a boy that could make it through St. Francis? And if so, we have the money to pay for him. So, and that's what happened to me, right? In the book, I think you've read that, you know, St. Francis came to get me after they saw my test score on the entrance exam. And that was, I'm tearing up a little bit, sorry. That was a huge turning point in my life when they came to get me.
You know, I guess I want to finish up this interview, Tom, by asking you, you know, you were afforded or given a lot of opportunities because there were people out there who recognized your potential, your talent, and your will to, you know, as you say, kind of bring yourself up. And somewhere there is this, I'm going to say in communities like ours, where there is a huge wealth gap, there are huge disparities of opportunity. And yet, at what point do you, can you recognize a kid who is going to benefit from the scholarship and to go on to do great things versus someone who might just, you know, live a life of for, you know, being given these kinds of opportunities? Right. I don't know if that explains what I'm trying to get at.
Right. How do you recognize the ones that are actually going to take it and run with it, you know, and it's going to make a difference? And what I said about the scholarship that we created when we created it was, we didn't just want to get, you know, find C-level kind of people and get them to A's. And I don't just mean in school grades, I mean sort of in life, but we wanted to get anyone that could sort of make it through and that it would change their life in a positive way, give them a better life than they otherwise would have had. I started mentoring a Black man today about 20 some years ago here in Boston when I met him when he was younger, through another organization here called the Stepping Stone Foundation. And I became his personal mentor. And I remember saying to them, you know, I would rather have someone who I think I could help the most, which is someone who's somewhat on the right path, and I can help that person achieve even more and get to a really high level, than someone I'm unsure of, because I wasn't sure I could help that person as much. There was no other reason than that. And it's worked out. It's been a lifelong, a 20 some year relationship now. We're very close. He's now married with two of his kids of his own, and he's had a very successful career. And having played a role in that is maybe more rewarding than having given all this money and sat on all these boards of these other organizations, right? That personal touch of doing that for someone.
Well, the book again is Animals I Want to See. It's a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Our guest is Tom Seaman. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
One out of every 200 kids will suffer from OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. That's roughly the same as those with juvenile diabetes. But unlike juvenile diabetes, it can take up to 17 years to receive an OCD diagnosis. So that means that most children with OCD will go through their entire childhood without proper treatment. We are joined by anxiety and OCD therapist Natasha Daniels, who is joining us to provide some valuable information for parents. And she has a new OCD workbook that will help. Natasha Daniels is an anxiety and OCD therapist and has three kids of her own who deal also with anxiety or OCD. Natasha Daniels, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I feel like in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, anxiety and OCD for young people has just exploded. And I'm wondering why someone like you, who's an OCD therapist, thinks that is.
I think there's many factors, and who knows, but I think there's more awareness. So that's helpful. I do think there's also a lot more stress in our day-to-day life that can be a trigger. And so kids have easy access to lots of stressors on tap with social media and being bombarded. Then we had COVID, which really could rock so many people's worlds. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into that.
When you and Mary Beth and I were kids, yes, there was not COVID at that point. And perhaps there was, I mean, certainly when I was a kid, there was no social media. What were the factors? How did we deal with anxiety and OCD then if we had it? I mean, I just felt like I would avoid things that made me feel that way.
Yeah, I think lots of people had anxiety and OCD. It's not like it just came onto the scene, you know, in this decade. I know I had my own anxiety. I know my siblings had their own anxiety and OCD issues. I think there was this just white knuckle it, get through, which unfortunately I think created more mental health issues down the road for adults. And you're seeing adults who are having much bigger issues because it wasn't addressed in childhood.
Most of us think about OCD, or not, maybe not most of us, but a lot of us think of it maybe as a lot of hand washing, right? Or rituals before you leave a doorway, something like that. But how might OCD manifest in a child? How might we see it that we wouldn't have thought of?
There's so many different ways that OCD shows up, most of which people are not aware of. And it shows up the same in children as it does adults. But I think people just don't know how it shows up in either way. Because it's about having an intrusive thought and the need to do something to get that brief relief. And then that could really be anything. So you can have harm intrusive thoughts where you are afraid you're going to harm yourself or harm other people. You can have moral and scrupulosity OCD thoughts where you think that you're a bad person or that you did a bad thing. You can have symmetry OCD where you need to even things out. There's so many different themes that look different but have the same framework of what OCD is actually.
And so one of the things I was able to take a look at your book, it's a wonderful book called Crushing OCD Workbook for Kids by Natasha Daniels, was its playful approach. It's kind of got such an interactive, engaging way. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I don't think that learning skills has to be boring, and kids won't pick up a workbook or engage in it if it is boring. And so it's like, how do you take these clinical skills and make it like bite-sized and engaging and fun and find metaphors that relate to kids so that they can get through treatment, even if they have to just pick up a workbook to do that because there's such a barrier to care.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with anxiety and OCD therapist, Natasha Daniels. She has a new book out, it's a workbook for kids called Crushing OCD. It's 50 fun activities to overcome OCD. Natasha, I'm wondering, I mean, it's really curious that you have three kids and they all deal with their OCD and anxiety issues. Obviously, as a therapist, you're able to recognize those sorts of things from the get-go, but what was your kid's journey with anxiety and OCD?
Yeah, people thought that I got into this work because of my kids, but I actually was into this work before I had kids. And you're making a really great point that I do have that awareness. So I can see it a mile away. There was a lot of mental health issues in my family that got me into being a therapist. So, and a lot of anxiety, OCD, but other mental health disorders as well. So I knew like the probability was very high, but all those skills really helped me spot it early in my kids as well.
So how do you distinguish between anxiety and OCD? As Mary Beth said, you know, we have these kind of stereotypes that we think about OCD and we probably do about anxiety too. What are the differences?
Yeah, people think that OCD is like a manifestation of anxiety, and it's really not that at all. In fact, now they are characterized as diagnostically, they're in two different categories completely. OCD is not an anxiety disorder any longer. And part of that was because anxiety impacts the amygdala and OCD impacts the basal ganglia and the circuitry. So two different parts of the brain. Anxiety is about an overreactive amygdala where it's like an anxious response to something where other people may not get anxious about it. So maybe a lot of avoiding because that's anxiety's fuel line. Where OCD is about a glitch where something gets stuck in the circuitry of the brain. And so you are trying to rid yourself of this intrusive thought, but you're not getting the message from the brain that you're good, move on. And so you are stuck into this loop of compulsions over and over again.
What are some of the most, if you had to kind of pinpoint a few of the approaches that seem to be most effective at the moment with kids with OCD, what would you recommend?
The evidence-based approach that is kind of the go-to approach is ERP, which is a type of cognitive behavioral therapy. It stands for exposure response prevention, which is systematically exposing them to that trigger, that intrusive thought or feeling, without them doing the compulsion. And some supplemental therapies that are really helpful are ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, and SPACE, SPACE treatment approach of systematically pulling back the accommodations from the parent's perspective of what is fueling the OCD.
Wow, so kind of, I've heard a lot about exposure therapy, but that's really interesting to kind of wean them off the behavior a little bit. Is that what the SPACE is about?
Yeah, SPACE is Ellie Leibovitz's program out of Yale, where you are, because as parents, we're the metaphorical sink. And so we complete those loops all the time without realizing it. So our child has an intrusive thought and the compulsion is, I need to confess this to my mom. And so I say, Mom, I think maybe I stole some gum from your purse when I was three. And then the mom, without knowing it, might say, oh, honey, don't worry about that. You're, you know, 15, it's fine. And that's the compulsion, is the mom kind of like washes away the guilt and then they get stuck in a loop. And so through the SPACE program, they learn to pull that back, educate their child. This is what you're doing. This is what the compulsion is. I'm going to respond in a different way. I'm sorry that your OCD is bothering you right now, instead of doing what OCD wants to complete that loop. So that's what the SPACE approach does, is pulls that back. And I incorporate that in my workbook too, as far as like, what do the parents do? What can the child do to collaborate with the parents and say, this is what you do for my OCD, not for me. And this is what you should do instead.
Oh, like a much better awareness of what's going on. So you're not just a victim of this circle.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's really interesting. So can you just go into maybe another example of that same sort of thing? So you use the example of, I think I stole something, a piece of gum from your purse when I was three. Can we go into another type of example to know how parents might deal with it and how we're dealing with it incorrectly?
There are so many. So you've got the confessing and the reassurance seeking. So that was an example of confessing. A reassurance one might be saying, I'm sorry, excessively. And then the parent says, it's okay, which is so minor, because it's great that kids say, I'm sorry. So that one gets missed a lot, because it's an extreme that takes a while to happen, where you're like, oh my gosh, why are you saying I'm sorry all the time? But some other ones in different themes might be, Mom, this food looks weird. And I'm saying mom just because that often is the go-to targeted person to complete the loop. Not always, but this food looks weird. Is it okay to eat? Or you might have someone with a different theme where they're like, Mom, I was putting the Clorox on the floor. You know, I was wiping the counter with the Clorox wipe, and then I think I touched my mouth. Do you think it's poisonous? Do you think it's okay? Or I touched my nose and then I touched my mouth. Is that okay? So a lot of, I did this behavior, am I safe now? That's another example.
Okay, so I know, you know, we're primarily talking about your workbook, which is dealing with OCD and the exposure therapy, but I'm also curious if you could just quickly address exposure therapy with anxiety. I just have someone very close to me, a young woman who has suffered from anxiety, and she has very specific and targeted forms of exposure therapy that have really worked well. So could you just comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, treatment for anxiety looks, and even exposure therapy looks very different, I think, for anxiety, because you've got that cognitive behavioral component with anxiety. And so, and I'll use myself as an example. I'm going to reframe my cognitive distortions. You know, I have social anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, which is different than my kid's OCD. And so I might be really anxious about presenting. I had to present this weekend. I was very anxious. It was like with the actual audience. I'm great online, but audiences, that's really scary to me. But there was a lot of cognitive reframing before then, which you don't do with OCD, where I'm saying to myself, I'm here to help other people. This isn't about me. If it falls flat, it doesn't matter. I can get through this weekend no matter what. So a lot of cognitive distortions are being reframed so that I go in there with a different mindset, which we don't do that with OCD per se. And then, yes, exposing yourself to a situation that triggers that in whatever way you're comfortable and you build up. I mean, this is a long journey. This was like a huge exposure for me to do. But I didn't start there. I started just talking to like the cashier at like Walmart. You know, that was my first step.
I love that. It's kind of like baby steps. We all go back to what about Bob at some point. And this idea that, you know, you don't yodel the first day. You got to work up to these things, you know, a little bit at a time. What would be the first step if you're a parent or even a teacher who's perhaps identifying that some of these habits might be going on in a kid in your life?
Yeah, the first step is definitely education. And so taking a deeper dive in what is OCD. So listening to podcasts or reading a book or taking a course, you know, really understanding the different flavors and disguises of OCD, and then getting an assessment. It can't hurt to get an assessment and getting it with the right type of therapist, because it's really unfortunate that most mental health therapists are not specifically trained in how to assess and treat OCD.
So yes, what kind of therapist would be ideal for that?
Yeah, I think that's the hard part, is that there's a lot of therapists that say, I can treat OCD, I can treat anxiety, I can treat ADHD, and they don't have the training. So, I mean, the best start is go to like the International OCD Foundation. They have a provider directory, so you're at least in the right spot. Somebody knows that organization, then it's more likely that they have the skills. You're looking for someone who mentions ERP when you were talking about kids and OCD, not just CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Do you remind us what ERT is one more time?
ERP is exposure response prevention. So it's a type of CBT, but it is a specific type that you have to get that training for.
I see. Thank you. If you look up somebody and you're not sure whether your child has maybe experienced some anxiety, just regular growing pains of life, or OCD, if you look up one of these certified therapists, they should be able to help you differentiate?
Yes, there are assessment tools. There's like the CyBox, which is an assessment tool that can diagnose OCD.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mm.
So something that you were talking about a minute ago, Natasha, struck me. So you talked about your own anxiety disorder, and you mentioned that you had to present in front of an audience over the weekend, and that gives you anxiety. And it brings up this question to me. I would say that maybe there's about 2% of the population who doesn't feel some sort of nervousness, stress, anxiety about presenting in front of public, because, you know, you have all these faces staring back at you. You know, the public speaking is like the number one fear ahead of even death for a lot of people. Yeah. It's about, my question is about how we label these things. Like, I would say that I'm nervous. I don't think I experience true crippling anxiety about these things, but boy, do I get nervous. I'm just wondering about the questions you can ask yourself, and maybe we can direct our children towards in asking themselves, like, is this just nervousness or is this anxiety? And does the difference matter, I guess?
Yeah, that is a great question, because especially with anxiety, OCD is a different beast, you know, so that's a separate category. But with anxiety, it is normal to get anxious when you're presenting. It is normal to get anxious maybe before taking a test. It's the acuity. And so I think it's the acuity of the situation. How intense does it happen? How frequently does it happen? And is it impacting someone's ability to function on a daily basis? And so for me, like walking to the mailbox was overwhelming, because I felt like as I'm walking down the street to the mailbox, all my neighbors can see me outside their you know, from their windows. So that's obviously, most people don't have that, you know? So yeah. It's the acuity of it. And so if your child is having stomach aches before they go to school every day, you know, and then they're fine on the weekends, or your child can't go to birthday parties and they can't function, or they can't go to sleep at night because they're worried about bad guys, and or they can't eat because they're worried they might choke. It's the severity of it and how it's impacting their daily life.
Okay. In your workbook, it's so great because you really divide it up into all of these different parts that first help us recognize how, you say, understanding OCD and its many disguises. You mentioned a couple of those right in the beginning, the different types of compulsion or OCD behaviors. And there's one that I'm kind of curious about, the values. You say OCD robs you of these things, which is values related. What's that about?
And that could be any theme, you know, where OCD will target something that you care about. Like with moral OCD, and I mentioned that before, sometimes called scrupulosity OCD, And these are themes. I just want to back up and say these are themes. So you don't have only moral OCD. I mean, it morphs and it changes. That's important for parents to realize. But moral OCD could be, I have an upsetting thought and now I need to pray to God compulsively. Or I have a bad thought, so now I have to like negate that with a positive thought. And so all day long, I am doing mental compulsions, non-physical, of canceling out my thoughts, which as a parent, we may not even know that our child is doing that. They might just look like they're spacing off when they're compulsively praying or compulsively negating a negative thought.
Yeah. Wow, that must be so distracting for young people, anyone suffering from OCD. It'd be hard to engage with life if you have these back burner ideas and needs happening all the time. Would you mind sharing a couple of the, giving a couple examples of exercises from your workbook? It looks great and it looks fun. Like you want to jump into it and play with it and see, share with our listeners some of the kind of exercises.
Yeah, I really wanted to take what I would do in my therapy practice and walk kids through that in the workbook. So it starts off, they're building blocks. And so it starts off with understanding what OCD is, what their flavors are, getting to identify the buckets of the different themes. And then I talk to them about personifying it because externalizing OCD is really important so that we can, if the child's comfortable, like name it, give it a funny name and then draw it. So we can see it as something outside of us. And so I encourage kids to kind of come up with a name. And then the parent can say, I'm sorry, Mr. O is bothering you right now. What can we do to crush Mr. O? So now it's me and my child against OCD versus me being, not against my child, but me being frustrated or struggling with my child. And so that can really help self-esteem and empowerment.
Sure. Does OCD run in genetics? Is this something that a parent might notice a few things about themselves as they identify it in their child?
It happens a lot because there is a genetic component. Not all, you know, it's about, I don't know, statistically, I won't even say but it's not everything, but there is a high genetic component that runs in families. And then there's the environmental influence that kind of waters that genetic seed that doesn't always get watered. But
sure.
A lot of parents in my communities will have this aha moment where they're like, oh my gosh, I have OCD because it is genetic.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of parents whose children are on the autism spectrum notice little things in their own lives when they look back at their history that they think, oh, that could be a part of that puzzle. And one last follow-up with that, is this something that kids will just grow out of? Or is treatment really critical to them, you know, making it into adolescence and adulthood healthily?
Yeah, OCD is a very debilitating disorder, one of the most debilitating disorders. And it is a chronic condition, unfortunately. So just like, you know, diabetes or asthma, it has to be treated and maintained. But early intervention and being proactive and giving kids tools early on, like it's just part of their life, is really important because it can be easily managed so that it's not disruptive into adulthood.
I'm wondering, Natasha, you know how a lot of times we take these little challenges that we have in life and there are ways to turn them into your superpower, you know, whether it's ADHD or even dyslexia or something like OCD or anxiety. Again, this young woman that I'm very close with, in a way she's turned it into her superpower because she gets so anxious if she doesn't have everything planned out. So she plans so far ahead and that has gotten her great jobs. It's gotten her great opportunities because she is meticulous about looking ahead. And then that helps with her anxiety as well. So I say like, oh, wow, if I had a little anxiety, maybe I wouldn't be so much of a procrastinator. If I had a little more OCD, maybe my house wouldn't be so messy. And it's, you know, I don't mean to be joking about a very serious disorder for some people that is crippling, but I think you probably know what I'm getting at is, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And I think they're two different things. And I see it with anxiety. I agree. You know, like I'm a planner. I am well planned. I will never drop a ball. That's never going to happen in my world because of my anxiety. And so that is helpful. I feel like the superpower of anxiety though, isn't about that per se. I think it is the compassionate, kind-hearted person that tends to have anxiety. With OCD, it's not helpful because I'm not going to have a clean house. I'm going to, and a lot of times they don't, they're hoarders or it's really really gross or there's contamination so they can't touch anything, but I'm stuck on a loop. So I'm actually going to be not as productive often because I can't move past what I'm stuck on. But the superpower with OCD is the things that come besides OCD. It's the OCD brain, which is the out-of-the-box thinker, super creative, often highly intelligent, can see things other people can't see, which is part of how the mechanisms of OCD are working. But the beautiful part is they're so creative, so out of the box. And so many successful people have OCD.
Wow. I'm really glad you made that clarification. As a means to sort of wrap up the interview, can you just give us from your workbook a couple of things that parents can latch onto? Definite, do not do these things if your child is dealing with anxiety and then OCD.
Yeah, I think as parents, we don't want to see our kids suffer. And so we approach their pain with a rational problem-solving sort of mind. And so if they're afraid to touch doorknobs, well, then just get a tissue or just use your shirt. If they're afraid of their food, well, I'll just tell them that their food is okay. And the problem with OCD is that the more we accommodate the OCD, the more their OCD grows, the neural pathways grow. And so it is really important. You can't pull that back overnight, but to educate yourself about OCD, to not wait and see, to get an assessment, educate your child because they don't know what's going on. There is a lot of relief in knowing that you're not alone and that it's a disorder and that you're not crazy. There's no shame in it.
What would be a better response rather than kind of validating or keeping that OCD forward?
You'd have to work with your child. They would understand that they are feeding Mr. O. And so once you have that in place, it might be something like, I'm sorry, Mr. O is trying to get fed. I wonder what you can do that Mr. O wouldn't like, or you might have a plan. Like you have a plan ahead of time of what you're going to say or what you're going to do so that your child knows what you're going to say as well.
The workbook is called Crushing OCD. It's a workbook for kids, and it involves 50 fun activities to overcome OCD with CBT and exposures. Our guest is Natasha Daniels. Natasha, can you say once again what CBT stands for?
It's a cognitive behavioral therapy.
Excellent. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us. This is really important, and I hope parents and school counselors alike will grab your workbook for kids and help those kiddos through it.
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. You can always find our archive shows for The Mountain Life wherever you get your podcasts. Just look up KPCW The Mountain Life, or you can go to kpcw.org under the Shows tab to catch all of our archive shows. Thanks for tuning in.